Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives, a podcast created to share the stories of the most successful, innovative, and inspirational leaders in Los Angeles. I'm Josh Schimmels, publisher and CEO of the Los Angeles Business Journal, and I'm here with my co-host, Todd Wilson, regional president of Greater Los Angeles for PNC Bank.
Thanks, Josh. Today's conversation is about breaking cycles, credit cycles, poverty cycles, and the systemic barriers that have kept generations from building wealth.
It's also about innovation, not just innovation in general and in tech, but in mindset. Our guest is the co-founder of a company that's revolutionizing the way we think about rent and credit and also financial inclusion.
And our guest didn't just build a company, he built a movement, one that's now active in millions of rental units across this country and helping people who've been left out of credit for years to get in the credit system and finally be seen.
From Lagos, Nigeria to the boardrooms of Wall Street, his journey is one of hustle, heart, and a mission to level the playing field.
He's the co-founder and CEO of Esusu, one of the few Black-founded fintech unicorns in the United States.
Wemimo Abi, welcome to C-Speak.
Thanks for having me.
Wemimo, I want to thank you for your time. I'm really excited to have you here and to hear more about your story because your product is so important to so many people. And I think a lot of us would probably agree, long overdue. But before we talk about the product, let's talk about you for a minute. Your personal story, from Lagos to leading one of America's few Black-founded unicorns, is a really impressive one. How have your lived experiences shaped the leader that you are today?
You know, I stand on the shoulders of so many people, and my journey started in the slums of Lagos, Nigeria. I lost my father at the age of 2. And I was raised by my mother and two very spirited sisters. And one thing my mother fundamentally believed in was the power of education. My mother barely graduated high school, and she worked at the post office for over 21 years. And she always believed education was the most important investment you can have in any child's life. So she afforded my school fees to one of the best high schools in Nigeria. And that's what led me to the United States. When I went to that high school and when all the kids we're going to the United States and Europe. I got into university in Nigeria at just over 15 years old. I decided to do the gap year and got admitted to the US. And I got admitted to one of the cheapest universities in America, which is the University of Minnesota. I immigrated from 80 degree weather in Lagos to negative 22 degrees in Minnesota. But during that transition, something important happened. My mom and I did not have a credit score. We walked into one of the biggest banks in Minneapolis to borrow money, and we're turned away and had to go borrow money from a predatory lender. And my mother sold my dad's wedding ring, borrowed money from church members also. But that experience led us to borrow money from a predatory lender and fundamentally changed the course of our lives. So inspired by that experience, that's what sort of led me and my co-founder Samir to start Esusu. Built on three core premises: where you come from, what you look like, or your financial identity should never determine where you end up in the wealthiest nation the world has ever seen.
Esusu tackles credit invisibility, for lack of a better word, a challenge affecting millions of people in the United States. When did you first recognize that this is not just a moral imperative, but also a business opportunity that you could scale?
You know, one of my mentors always said, math has no opinion. And let me share the math here. There are over 110 million people that rent in this country. They send over $1,100 to their landlords every month. If you do that math and annualize it, renters send $1.4 trillion to their landlords every year. But less than 10% of that data showed up on their credit score. But when you pay your mortgage, that data shows up on your credit score. So the question is, how do we give credit where credit is due so we can help people be seen? I said earlier, when we came here, no one could see us. Not because the banker didn't want to give us money or borrow us money, because we didn't have enough financial identity to be seen. So when we saw this huge market opportunity, we said, wow, if we can help everyday Americans be seen, we can not only allow that $1.4 trillion to be factored in their credit score. There are over 45 million people in America that have no credit score or what we consider credit invisible. So they have a thin credit profile. The average debt is over $90,000. If you do that math also, that's over $4.1 trillion we leave on the table. So it was simple. how do we try as much as possible to make this a business imperative where people can be seen and above all, get access to capital and hopefully help live the proverbial American dream?
I mean, the numbers are astounding. And, you know, as we think about startups, so many focus on being mission driven, but very few are able to build profitable businesses around social impact. How does Esusu ensure that both purpose and performance are always in sync? How do you combine those together?
It's really hard. That's the bottom line. I will not put lipstick on a pig and say it's the easiest thing to do. If you're running a pure for-profit enterprise, you control for one variable, excess capital you can return back to your shareholders.
Profitability.
Exactly. Mm. Profitability is number one. Well, we have to sort of find this delicate line, which is doing well and doing good. So making sure you outperform and control for profitability, at the same time, looking out for the best interest of folks so you can create this win-win-win outcome. And that's sort of what led us to create this business. But it takes a lot of discipline, values-driven approach to running a business and trying as much as possible to be maniacal focused on the customer's needs.
It seems as if the social impact portion might have come first in your case.
Yes. Social impact is above all important in this case. It's a huge market opportunity. You know, when the meaning of Esusu in and of itself, the company is, if you want to go fast, you go alone. But if you want to go far, we fundamentally need to go together. And that's the ethos of what guides me every day. I'd walked in Wall Street, I'd walked in different institutions, but really wanted to try as much as possible to think about how we create a win-win-win solution. More practically for us, it's just, we have a unique responsibility, especially in this country. You know, I come from the slums of Lagos. America gave me everything. I could stick to corporate America and make all the money in the world, but I wanted to pay back. I wanted to do something that was bigger than myself. And working alongside my colleagues at Esusu, who do exceptional work, it's the honor of my life.
And I assume your investors understand, obviously, that you need to have social impact with making money.
Absolutely. Investors understand that, you know, when any investor that put money in Esusu, we have something called a master plan. And a master plan is unapologetic. It's sort of this document that guides where we're going to as a company. It's a three-pronged strategy. We help people be seen, financial identity. We help people be stable. If someone can pay rent, what other financial resources can they get access to? And help them build wealth. And when we do those things, we can generate serious alpha, return money to our investors, and also do well in society. But it's a long-term game. There's no shortcut to success in this game.
When you started this business, you were doing something that no one had ever done before in terms of trying to get the credit bureaus to recognize rent.
Right.
How did you get them to buy into the model? And what strategies or proof points did you use to get them on board?
You know, one of my favorite quotes is, it is the folks that you don't believe will do something special, that do the things that would inspire you and change the world. I have always lived my life outside the box, not inside the box. And the destitution of my social position growing up and when I came to this country was sort of how I saw and my co-founder the addressable market opportunity. When we got in this business, the question for us was always, how do we create a virtual cycle of this win-win outcome? So let me explain it. We go to large owners and operators of real estate and say, hey, we want to help people establish or build their credit score. Your real estate can pay you rent. You need people to pay you rent. So we bet on those people and make sure they are very financially resilient by making sure they have good credit. If you have a poor credit, it can cost you over $250,000 in interest over your lifetime. And if people are struggling with interest rate, they might not be able to pay you rent in the first place. So the old thesis for us is this idea of a win-win-win. A win for the landlords that bring us in, a win for the residents, and a win for society at large.
How do the landlords benefit from what you're doing?
The landlord benefits, once again, I'll go back to math. Data from one of the credit bureaus suggests that when people get their data reported into the credit bureaus, 7 out of 10 residents will pay their rent on time.
Oh, so they're more likely they know to pay it on time.
Exactly, because they're getting benefits for actually doing something. People just, renters feel like when they pay rents, it just goes down the gutter, right? But now they get credit for it. In addition to that, we've also started pairing people up. If you can't pay your rent, instead of your landlord evicting you, we have financial products whereby they can essentially get access to eviction prevention dollars from us, pay overtime. We pay that money directly to their landlord. So the landlord wins, right? Doesn't have to evict someone. Gives the resident a little bit of time, maybe to find a job, or if they work 2 shifts, they don't have to get charged late fees. And society at large, the average cost of eviction in America when someone is on the street, it's $50,000. We've helped now improve credit scores within our ecosystem over 4 million people in this country, right? And provide eviction prevention dollars to tens of thousands of people. That saved this country billions of dollars. That's making sure your taxpayers' money doesn't go to help people solve homelessness backwards, right? It's making sure your taxpayers' money is actually going to hopefully improve the public school in your neighborhood. So that's how we create this trifecta of a win, win, win across society.
Did you have to change your messaging or shift your positioning when presenting Esusu to different audiences? As an example, you've got one message perhaps to the credit bureaus.
Right.
And then there's the investors.
Right.
And then there's the landlords and then the everyday renters. Was it a different pitch?
That's the benefit of running a company like we run. Trying as much as possible to help Americans live their financial best and eventually everyone across the world. So it wasn't necessarily the core of what we do did not require a different pitch, but the outcomes we're talking to, you require a different message for different stakeholders. So when I'm talking to investors, it is, we're going to do well and we're going to do good and we're going to outperform. And I hope the numbers speak for itself. For our residents, it is more or less, how do we help you live your financial best? How do we help you be seen? And how do I take you on that home ownership journey one day or get you access to quality financial products or make sure you don't pay $250,000 in interest over your lifetime? And then for the landlords, it's simple. Positive net operating income, right? Because you don't want to evict people and then turn the units around. You also want your residents to pay your rent on time. And then we also have different product that makes sure this platform is solid. We just acquired a company in January that does fraud and prevention, which for the past 4 years has been one of the things that our clients are struggling with. So what we are building at Esusu is not just a tree. It's a forest of quality products that serves multiple stakeholders, which requires different messaging.
Do you think there will be a day where a renter can get this type of benefit from a private landlord, as opposed to like an institutional property manager?
It's a fantastic question. So we're doing that today. Anyone can go to our website and download a mobile application and make that visible. And we worked really hard to make that happen. We're using a lot of machine learning. We've been doing this for 5 years. We have to look through someone's bank account and look through hundreds of thousands of records and take out rental data for the past 24 months. Because we can report historical rent payments. So this is really, really innovative stuff that we've been able to accomplish, which is powerful.
So powerful concept when you came up with this, but I also know it was not easy to raise the money.
It was hard.
So I know you recently raised $130 million in a Series B financing.
Yeah.
But again, it's not an overnight success. How did your pitch evolve with the potential investors and how did the company's narrative evolve along the way?
You know, a lot of CEOs always talk about what they did, but all the credits, in my opinion, goes to my team, investors, and a bunch of people that have backed us. But before that, I'm going to talk about a story. When we started raising money for Esusu, we went to 326 investors. Yes, I keep scores. It's 326. A lot of them said no to us, or all of them at that point said no to us. And quite frankly, there was a lot we could learn from that experience. Storytelling, talking about the addressable market, talking about the opportunity. But that was still sad of people just saying no after no after no, but we kept on going. One of the darkest days on that journey was, and I still have this photo in my office every day. I look at it just to remind me. My business partner and I got our first $20,000 contract from the University of Minnesota. They probably felt bad for me and gave us that contract, which is my alma mater. But both of us were in $100,000 in credit card debt because many people had said no to us, but we believed in ourselves and just continued to push forward. And because we had so much debt, we couldn't afford an hotel room. So we're in Fargo, North Dakota that night, going out of the airport, coming to San Francisco to raise more money. And something really interesting happened. We went to a Denny's, one of our favorite restaurants, and I had a genius idea. And the genius idea was, it's 24 hours. We're going to order a Grand Slam and eat Denny's all night and then take the flight to San Francisco the next day. Unfortunately for us, we started dozing off because we had to take the train the day before for like 6 hours and didn't sleep well. So this was like a marathon for 48 hours. The restaurant manager, a very kind man, came up to us and said, guys, a lot of people employ this strategy. I have to kick you out. So we're kicked out of a Denny's around 4 a.m. in the morning and I had to go sit on one of those massage chairs at the airport because TSA wasn't open. I share that story because when everybody sees $130 million we've raised, the company's valued at $1 billion, you know, it took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get to this point and continues to do. Running a business is incredibly hard. There's no such thing as an overnight success. But that's why we do what we do. It's trying as much as possible, you know, to show others that if you work hard, if you do what you're supposed to do, maybe you can get to this level. And the funny story when we raised $130 million was I called my mother because when I was leaving corporate America, she's just like, this stupid boy, you know, I invested everything in you. She came to the office in New York and said, wow. We made it. This is amazing. And I said, yeah, I'm leaving to go start this company with my best friend. And she said, you know, she was crying. She's like, I thought we made it. This is horrible. So when we raised this money, I called her up and I said, hey, mom, we just raised $130 million and the company is valued at $1 billion. Guess what my mother said?
Congratulations, I bet not.
No? This is someone that barely has a high school degree. She said, how's the wedding planning coming along?
When are the grandkids coming?
Exactly. That's all she cares about. She's like, when is the procreation going to happen?
I didn't see that coming.
But the reason why you don't see that coming, once again, my mother is outside of the box. She doesn't understand that a kid from the slums of Lagos, Nigeria, that she birthed, a postal office worker that barely graduated high school, that her kid could run a company valued at $1 billion or $130 million. My mother works as a personal care aide. She works two jobs and she has a lot of pride. And she still does that today, regardless of anything I have. That's the true genius of America.
So you talked about just keep going. Nearly 350 investors.
326.
Said no.
Boy, lots have said yes after that 326.
Is there any specific advice that you'd give to other mission-driven founders, especially from underrepresented communities who are also navigating investor skepticism?
The three advice I have. Nothing in life is worth doing alone. The only reason why throughout this year, it's going to be 10 years since we ever thought about this idea. My co-founder, Samir, the partnership we have, the fundamental values we've created to make sure this company is what it is really powerful. So for founders out there, number one, find yourself a partner or an exceptional team. Because when you have that, during the darkest days, during the troubled nights, when people tell you no constantly, it's always good to have someone to say, I know we're in this together and you're not at it alone. If I was doing this alone, I don't think I'm going to last this long. You know, there's a lot of collateral damage from running a company.
Yeah.
And I used to have air, now I'm bald. So that's one. Number two is you need to be values driven. You know, my grandmother always says, a man or a woman that doesn't stand for something will fall for anything. You need to be values driven. What drives you? What makes you get out of bed? Money's not enough. At some point, you look at yourself in the mirror. If you're running for money, you're going to feel empty. But what drives you? That is something that you need to focus on, especially if you want to go on this painful road of entrepreneurship. And you need to use those values to hire, fire, or promote people in your company, because those are the people that you want to elevate. If someone is smart but treat people poorly, they don't belong at our company. They need to go. You need to make sure you have something that you stand by that is the backbone of what you focus on. And then number three, which I will always guide people to stay maniacally focused on, is your customer. You need to have an obsession with your customer. You can never get so arrogant. If a client that has 1,200 units calls me today, I will pick up their phone and talk to them. And if a client that has 1 million units calls me, I'll pick up the phone and talk to them. You need to stay maniacal. You need to stay obsessed with your customers and try as much as possible to deliver value for them. The day you let that go, the day you stop listening, is the beginning of the end.
You talked a lot about math and the numbers here. Today, you reach over 3 million rental units.
5 million rental units.
I'm sorry, my notes were wrong. Over 5 million rental units. How did you scale to this size? What were the challenges in doing so?
Scaling is all about one-to-many channels. We can't get to this point where we are without burning a lot of cash, going to you as a landlord and saying, one landlord at the time, and saying, hey, bet on us, right? And you have 2 units. You really have to have a strategy. The strategy for us was this idea of one-to-many and leveraging what we call the Pareto principle. What are the 20% of your clients that drive 80% of value? So in our case, in real estate, it's a very, very fragmented market, but there are certain owners that own a lot of apartment units. So we went to them, created this value proposition. It was hard. You know, I have people like Jeff Brodsky at Related Companies that put us through the ringer, right? The contracting period was over 9 months, but when we passed those checklists, people like that bet on us and made us what we are today. When we do a good job for them, they tell their friends, because real estate is a very insular market. But to answer your question about scale and get into where we are, it's just focusing on customers, advocates, looking at a map and say, who do you do business with that can create an exponential scale for you? And then create the rails where you can have a mass market product that even someone that has 2 units or even a renter can engage with you. So some of the things we've done is we have a business-to-business product where large owners and operators can get access to us. If a bank like PNC wants to use a SUSU, for example, we have something called rent reporting as a service where anyone at PNC can use us, but they don't know they're using us. They think it's PNC's service. It's embedded, right? So those are the ways we've been able to scale and have a thoughtful go-to-market, but it's this maniacal focus on customers that has helped us scale across, and we're just getting started. Think our landlords own 5 million doors, 13 million people. That's still, you know, 10% or so of the market. We have a long way to go.
Well, you've had some great partners and some major players, Goldman, SoftBank, and Amazon, to name just a few. What's your approach to building partnerships that creates long-term value for both parties?
It's win-win-win. We go to every situation studying our partners and seeing what they're doing and trying as much as possible to think about win-win-win and creating value for them. So even if you're Amazon, for example, they're doing exceptional work creating affordable housing in the United States. And there's a lot of public information about the endeavor that they work on. So the question for us is, we make the argument, if people report their rent, they will pay low interest over their lifetime. You know, we can try as much as possible to add value. And for a company like Amazon, who's also maniacally focused on customer and quality, that's very, very important to them. So what we do a lot is study in a very, very thoughtful way our clients, focus on their needs, and execute with precision. We all make mistakes, there's no doubt about that. But just trying as much as possible to understand our customers' needs. If it's a bank, if it's a large company, a large global company, if it's a large owner and operator, if they are talking to us, there's a reason. You got to understand the value of what they're looking for, their needs, and then create a platform where you can create something that they might not also think they need. And we've had the good fortune of working with large institutions, even government-sponsored agencies like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. It's saying, how do you create that value across board? But you need to be very, very intentional about the customer.
Let's shift for a second and talk about some of the impact that Esusu is having, not just in terms of dollars, but the impact from systematic change.
Yes.
How do you measure that impact?
Absolutely. So everyone that works with us, we do something whereby measuring impacts, as by now you can tell I'm a math guy. If it's not, if the numbers are not there, it doesn't really matter because you got to measure. So let me tell you some of the ways we measure. We look at the number of people that have established credit scores, right? So these are people like my mother and I that came to this country and never had a credit score. We've established credit scores for over 250,000 people. They don't have anything on their credit
score.
Brand new. We're the first thing on their credit score. 250,000 people across the country. Number two, we look at the average credit score jump. The average credit score jump at Esusu is 45 points.
So for your tenants?
Yes. 45 points might seem like, oh, that's nothing. But if you're buying a house and you're at a 680 and you need to get a 700, 45 points will get you to, you know, a 725, right? So that's meaningful on the kind of interest rates you're going to get or even get access to that home in the first place. One of the numbers I'm most proud of in this company is the impact number. For those people that have established or built their credit scores, they've gone on to unlock over $50 billion. Over $50 billion in credit activities. Of that $50 billion, $30 billion of that is mortgages. You got auto loans, quality credit cards, student loans, and other loans.
So it's allowed them to buy homes,
exactly.
Go to university,
exactly.
Buy cars.
That is the proverbial American dream. You might have had people that otherwise won't qualify for a mortgage, and we're giving them that opportunity to establish their financial identity, be stable, and build wealth. It's the tried and true way of building wealth in this country of home ownership. That $30 billion number is very, very important because it shows that you can not only take people through the continuum, you can help them thrive.
Well, you're giving access. And as we mentioned earlier, for years, rent wasn't factored in the credit scores, which to me is sort of crazy because if you think about it, it's often one of the largest monthly payments that people make.
It is. 30 to 50% of folks' monthly expense, renters especially, they spend it on rent.
Why do you think it took so long for this change to happen?
You know, we live in a construct in America where the credit system, the way it's designed is it treats you like you're guilty until proven innocent. Mm-hmm. You got to have debt and you have to pay your debt consistently to be seen. But what happens if you never had debt? What happens if you're new in this country? So the rental data was not seen as a debt obligation. So it took folks like us, once again, that are outside the box and say, wow, we're leaving a lot of Americans behind. If someone lives in South Dakota or North Dakota and grew up on a farm, like what's the point of having credit, right? In Minnesota, we start driving at 14 years old, right? But those people might be discriminated if their parents did not add them on their credit card at the age of 12 or at the age of 14. And not a lot of people have that kind of knowledge. So what we're trying to do is everyday things. Rent is a big one. Do I want to know that you paid your rent for the past 5 years? Is that a better gauge for me to give you a mortgage if you can pay to have a roof over your head? Or if you have a 600 credit score and the thing that hurt your credit score is because, you know, you had a medical debt that you couldn't afford. But you're prioritizing your rent and throughout you paid your rent, right? So that we need to just look at the things that are most important. And some of the most exciting things that has happened now, I've had the opportunity to testify in Congress to talk about this work and bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle. And what we are seeing right now is the federal government now, especially Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, anyone that has a rental data can now be factored into your mortgage underwriting procedure. Something we've been fighting for years and years. So, and by September, all the banks through FHA, FHFA, a lot of institutions across the country, rental data will now be used for mortgage underwriting. That's what we set out to do, right? And I'm so glad that's happening this year.
Well, you talked earlier about AI and technology.
Right.
you know, Isuzu is a data-powered platform.
Yes.
How are you using AI or maybe analytics to enhance the user experience?
So we've always been using AI at the company because you have to look at rental data and pass that information and report it to the credit bureaus. That's always been core. But I fundamentally believe Warren Buffett once said, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. I believe AI is the ninth wonder of the world. It's going to change everything we do. So let me give you three solid applications in terms of what we're doing. We see a sea of transaction data. So if we're working with an institution like PNC and we're reporting rental data, we can capture all that information, look at people's transaction, create rules, foundational models to pinpoint their rental data and report it into the credit bureau. So a machine learning team, an engineering team at the company is doing that day in, day out today. Number two, if you go to our website today, you can chat with someone 24 hours. That's powered by, you know, large language models where we feed a lot of information into it. And eventually, actually next month, when you call the company, you're going to be talking to someone and you're going to feel like it's a human being, obviously, but you're going to be talking to Serena. No pun intended. Yeah. Serena Williams is invested in the company. Also, big shout out to her. And you're going to talk to Serena, very, very emotionally in tune, thoughtful, and there to help you across board. You know, another way we're also leveraging AI is identity. Trying as much as possible to capture data on people so we can better price risk. So if you're, you know, have a credit score and a underwriter needs additional information from you, how do we leverage different data infrastructure to capture information to make sure that you get access to that information? So those are real life use cases to do the things we do every day. We've been doing this for a long time. And then on the customer support side, it's been powerful. And then lastly, trying as much as possible to focus on this use case. There's a plethora of applications I can bore you with, but I'm really, really excited about artificial intelligence. We actually said, we sent out a memo 2 months ago called Isuzu's Refounding Moment. We will not hire anyone that doesn't have a point of view on AI and engineering. That's just baseline. And then everyone within the team, we're unleashing tools. Engineers are using vibe coding. They're using AI to essentially help them accelerate the boring things about coding. I use it also. I just created a mock-up last night leveraging a tool. It's a must-have at the company.
So, Mimo, you've talked about the impact that you want to have in this community and the social impact you want to have towards homeownership, towards helping people afford universities. What do you hope people remember about the company and your leadership and how that fits into the American landscape?
Wow. I'll make it a little bit more morbid. When my lease expires on this thing called life, I want Isuzu to be known as a company that gave voice to the voiceless, that helped people, especially low to median income people, be seen. There's a lot of people like my mother that work two jobs, try to make ends meet, move things around to make sure their kid have a successful life. And we want to build products for those people, even if they are in Compton, they're in Pasadena, they're in South Dakota, they're in Minnesota, they're in Maine, they're in Vermont, they're in Appalachia, regardless of where you are in this country. The ethos, the clarion call of the company, I want everyone to say that company, regardless of what you look like, regardless of how much money you have in your pocket, and regardless of where you come from, they stood by me and they provide quality financial products to help me live the American dream and hopefully people around the world too.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you for what you're doing. You're an immigrant. You came here to the U.S. with nothing. You've pulled yourself up through education, through family, and now you're trying to do that for others. And you've had a huge impact on millions of lives, giving them the glorious American dream of homeownership. I really appreciate what you've done and wish you all the best in going forward.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. My advice to everyone is, regardless of how tough life gets, just be caught trying. You're going to get knocked down. Wake up every day trying to contribute to your own humble quota. So one day when you're a deathbed, you tried. And there's nothing what, you know, living life on than that, in my own humble opinion. We all got to try to leave this thing better than we found it.
Well said. Thank you so much, Wamimo. Your leadership reminds us that most meaningful companies aren't just built on capital, they're built with conviction. We appreciate you sharing your journey, the bold vision that you bring into life that really impacts so many different people and will continue to impact people for a long time. On behalf of the Los Angeles Business Journal and PNC Bank, thank you all for listening. To ensure that you're notified about our future podcast releases, please be sure to subscribe or follow. Thank you again. We look forward to hosting you on the next episode of PNC C-Speak, the language of executives.